Amen. Please be seated. Well, we have not sprung forward. We've fallen back. Happy end of daylight savings, for what that is worth. You have officially gained an extra hour of time on planet Earth. Or that's what the major media outlets have told me. I got an email from the New York Times yesterday saying, "How will you make use of your extra hour?" Melissa Kirsch was writing me this email. I don't know her, but she said, "Every first Sunday in November, I contemplate becoming a different, better person, one who gets up 1 hour earlier to meditate or exercise or meal prep. And every first Sunday in November, I do none of these things. I spend the extra hour in bed, trying to go back to sleep, probably fretting a little about how I'm squandering this precious opportunity to begin leading a truly productive life." Now, when it comes to the ironies of the church year, at least, there is no greater irony than the fact that the time change often falls on what we call All Saints Sunday. Today is All Saints Sunday. All Saints is one of the great earliest and greatest feast days in the church. It's the day when we remember those who've departed in faith, and you'll hear their names read at the end of the service. So it's we gain time on the day when we commemorate its loss. In fact, all of the readings you've just heard read are taken from our burial liturgy. They are the funeral passages that are read when people die. And the one from Isaiah says something very bold about what it's like to be a person on planet Earth, in that it is a person over whom a shroud is cast. All of us, there is a shroud that is cast over all peoples, a sheet that is spread over all nations. And that shroud, that sheet, is death. You and I can live in denial that we are all living under this shroud. The hustle and bustle of the fall gives us plenty of occasion not to think about death. But the Bible speaks this truth, and All Saints Day speaks it, even emphasizes it. So it's a good day to acknowledge that the grief that each one of us carries by virtue of simply being alive. The reality is that the world is essentially full of people who have lost things. This church is full of people who have lost things. Yes, we've lost daylight. We've lost hair. We've lost color in our hair. We've lost muscle fiber and bone density, my doctor is reminding me. We lose, the trees lose their leaves. And speaking of trees, my father, apropos of nothing, sent me a picture yesterday of myself and my two brothers when we were like elementary school age. We're all like on a ladder leaning against an orange tree in Florida, where my mother's from. And he said, "This orange tree is now a subdivision." Because if you've been to Florida recently, you know that everything is a subdivision now. And what he was really saying, though, is that my mother's hometown is unrecognizable. And just like your hometown is unrecognizable, we suffer the loss of familiarity, and we suffer the not just of our own youth. But then there are more acute losses, are there not? Jobs that abruptly end, businesses that close, there are friends who move away, children who grow up. For those of us in the midst of raising children, Halloween can be a reminder of the fact that, gosh, my kids used to want to dress like Winnie the Pooh, and now they want to dress like Freddy Krueger, you know? Or they used to want to be together, and now they want to be apart. And we mark the passage of time, and there's an inevitable loss that one feels as a parent. That there's more acute losses than that, though. There are relationships that end. There are marriages that fall apart. And most tragically, there are loved ones who die. Loss is universal. To live is to lose, which means grief is universal. In a week when we're deeply almost overwhelmingly aware of the ways in which we are divided and separated as a country and as a culture. We are reminded this morning that we are united in the experience of loss, which means we are united in the experience of grief. Well, what is grief exactly? Well, Dolly Parton put it best. She said that grief is love with no place to go. Grief is love with no place to go. And the true story of our life, if you really get to know someone, you find out that the true story of a person's life is the story of loss. Love and loss. Another way to say this is if you want to understand another person, find out what they love. But if you want to love another person, find out what they've lost. The gospel passage for today finds Jesus entering a situation thick with loss and grief. He has received word that his friend Lazarus is sick, and by the time he arrives at the home that Lazarus shared with his sisters Mary and Martha, Lazarus is dead. Jesus is there too late. Lazarus has been in the grave 4 days, and his sisters are let down, profoundly disappointed. Mary and Martha express their grief as a mixture of sadness, frustration, stress, and blame. Martha says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." These ladies are a bunch of different stages of grief all wrapped up into one. They're a jumble. In other words, they're real people. This isn't scripted. These are real people speaking to Jesus. Now, what does Jesus do? Well, he sees their weeping, and John tells us that he's greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. The God who we are told in Isaiah will wipe away every tear starts to shed tears here. Jesus wept. Jesus weeps. He cries. And the Jews who are observing this say, "See how he loved him. See how Jesus loved Lazarus." There's a lesson here that we grieve to the extent that we love. Grief and love are forever sort of intertwined. You might say grief is the measure of our love. There was a beautiful clip on Sesame Street a couple weeks ago of Andrew Garfield, that wonderful actor, speaking with Elmo the Muppet. And Elmo asks Andrew, he says, "How are you today, Andrew?" And Andrew says, "Well, Elmo, I'm thinking about my mom who died recently, so I'm feeling sad." And Elmo says, "I'm sorry, Andrew." To which Andrew responds, "You don't have to be sorry, Elmo. It's okay to miss somebody. It means you really loved them when you miss them. It makes me feel close to her to miss her." And all of a sudden, Andrew starts to smile. He feels better because Elmo has listened to him in his grief. Well, Jesus is Elmo. What? Forget that. Jesus, when it comes to what Mary and Martha are doing, Jesus enters into their grief. Jesus shares their sorrow. He is our model for what it means to be with a grieving person. And again, if we are alive, we are grieving. There was a survey a few years ago that Slate, the website, did of people who are grieving, and they asked what was helpful and what was not helpful. And most of the grievers said that the most helpful thing was simply recognition. Instead of stressing that one day the mourner would, quote unquote, get over it, helpful friends shared stories about the deceased or just sat and held their hand while they cried. As one respondent wrote, "The most helpful thing was simply the willingness or ability of others to listen and accept my feelings, thoughts, and memories, whether they brought tears, laughter, or questioning, without responding with advice or redirection." Come to find out, sharing in grief, sharing in sorrow brings life, not more death. So, do you want to make good use of the extra time you've been given today, that extra hour? Well, if you do, well, then follow Jesus into the sorrows that surround you. Follow Jesus into the sorrows that surround you. That is what ministry is. Of course, if that's too much, and it often is, look to what Jesus does as well. Because Jesus does more than acknowledge the grief and weep with these sisters. After shedding his tears, he goes to the tomb. He tells them to roll away the stone, and he calls Lazarus out by name. And after Jesus calls him out by name, Lazarus comes forward. In other words, Jesus restores that which has been lost. He enters into sorrow not for the sake of the sorrow, but for the sake of redemption and resurrection. He unties the knot and braids it into something beautiful. And he did it then, and he hasn't stopped doing it since. And that, my friends, is what All Saints Sunday is actually about. It is about the following three things. First of all Saints is not about the remembrance of the dead, but a celebration of those who are in some way that we cannot understand or fathom are still with us, are still here. The communion of the saints, that where our prayer book says, happens every time we come to the altar. The witness, the great cloud of witnesses that surround us, those who have departed have not actually departed. I know that's an audacious thing to say, and it's not me saying it. It's Jesus. That there is a reality afoot that is deeper than the darkness and loss we perceive. There is light we cannot see. But secondly, we see that Jesus enters into a situation with zero hope. There's not a shred. This man has been dead for 4 days. There is a stench emanating from the tomb, which means if you yourself, in whatever you are grieving, have passed the point of hopelessness, well, God has not abandoned you. Jesus' power lasts beyond the expiration date of our hope and even our life. Thirdly, though, the form this power takes right now is a promise. The promise is that the grieving will not just be consoled, but that what's lost will be restored. A time is coming, Isaiah says, when death itself will be swallowed up, the shroud removed, when we will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. That is to say, when the depth of our grief will be revealed to be the measure of God's love and salvation. Amen.